introduce our main speaker. I just want to say that, this person, I see him at meetings on a regular basis, always seems to be calm, at peace, and definitely has a program that I want, and he has just a smidgen less than your 10-minute speaker, so let's welcome Ray. Come on up, Ray.
Funny thing happened on the way to Paso Robles yesterday. We made plans to go see the fair, okay? We got halfway there, we got up close to 41, and decided, let's go to Morro Bay. So we got into Morro Bay, let's go to Moonshine Beach, or whatever the heck it is up there. That's what we do today in sobriety. We just do on a spur of the moment, and we had fun doing it today. No plans, no nothing, you know. And then we had another, almost a disaster in our yard today. We got swarmed with thousands of bees. We stayed indoors. And I'm an alcoholic. My name's Ray. Pray for the God and Alcoholics Anonymous for my continued sobriety. And now that I got your attention, I can't even begin to pitch like she does. She has humor and I'm straight-laced. I wasn't brought up with humor in my life, at home or anywhere else, you know. I've learned my humor since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned how to smile since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me 3 years to get in front of a podium like this and laugh and have a gut-level laugh for the first time, you know. And that was down at a group down in San Fernando Valley. It was called the Gong Show. That was the name of the meeting. It was a program on TV, the Gong Show, and our meeting was named after that because I'm telling you, there was more crazy men and women down there you could shake a stick at. But they knew how to laugh. They knew how to bring the message to me when I really absolutely needed it because I didn't know how to laugh at all. You know, and it took me a long time, even on this program, to feel relaxed within myself, because I never felt relaxed within myself in my whole life. From the time I could remember, around 5 years old, I was beaten up by my grandmother. And prior to that, which I didn't know for a long time, I'm lucky to even be alive. I may have a bump on my head somewhere. I haven't been able to find it yet. But my mother fell out of a second-story window carrying my sister and me. And so everybody says, Ray, you're lucky to be alive. Well, okay. You know, that was the extent of it. But that's the way it was for me in growing up. We had no humor in our family. There was a lot of chaos in our family. There was a lot of drinking in our family. There was a lot of physical abuse in our family. You know, and in the neighborhoods that I lived in, there was a lot of bullying going on. Like today, you go to jail. Back then, you just beat the hell out of them with a brick. You know, and that's what I did. I carried a brick in my paper sack. You come after me, I'm going to get you, and I'm going to get you while you're down too. I'm not going to give you a break, because that's the way I was taught. I was taught how to fight dirty. You know, look at me today. You wouldn't think I was a scrapper, but I was. I was a skinny, runny kid, but I can sure outrun a lot of those bullies, you know, and I did. At 5'5", I was only 105 pounds, but I could carry my own, and that's the way it was until I found alcohol. I had to ask my sister this quite a few years ago. We went to my cousin's wedding, and he married an Italian girl, okay, beautiful lady. It was a big wedding. And so somehow we got a hold of, and I hope I don't offend anybody, it was called Dago Red Wine. Okay, and I had a big glass of it. And I still remember that. I remember where I drank it at, and it was on the south side of Youngstown, Ohio. Anybody here from Ohio? I hope not. But I remember that. But you know, I didn't connect anything to that. It gave me that warm feeling in my gut. I remembered that. I still remember that. And it was only until I hit my teens that I started tinkering with alcohol on the weekends with my school buddies, you know. and sneaking into bars back in Ohio, back in Youngstown, you know, 15 years old, and you had to be 18 to even drink 3-2 beer. You know, you couldn't get hard liquor. But we'd sneak into these bars. We knew where they were at. And we all, I didn't have a driver's license, so I rode with all these guys. And I got sick a lot. I always puked. You know, it always embarrassed me. You know, I thought I could handle this stuff, and I could. And I remember, somewhere around 15, 16 years old, somewhere in that range now, it doesn't matter, my little big brother, I call him my little big brother because he's bigger than I am, he outweighs me by maybe 20, 30 pounds yet. He says, "Ray, if you're not going to drink like a man, don't drink at all." And you know what that reaction was? I'll show you. And I've been showing the world for a long time after that. Believe me, I did. And if I got sick, they didn't know I got sick. I ran from them. I hid from them. I puked in silence if I had to. But they weren't going to know I was going to be sick. And that's what it did for me. And I kept going. You know, I loved. A lot of people said they didn't like the taste of alcohol. I liked the taste of alcohol for the first time I drank it. I really did. And I loved what it did for me at the very beginning. I just loved it. But, you know, when you're in high school and you don't have any money and you deliver papers, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of money there. And you didn't have a car. You had no means of transportation. So you had to go with all your friends. Who's going to go out drinking tonight? Who's going to hit these bars where the cops ain't going to come in and get you? Well, we'd go way out of town. We went in some bars I should never have been into. And I'm sitting there and I'm drinking with these guys and I'm petrified. I'm scared. I'm shaking. I can still remember those incidences. I'm really shaking. And how do I want to say this? By the time I was almost 18 years old, I had made up my mind at that time, I'm going to run away from home. I'm getting the hell out of Youngstown, Ohio. I'm going to leave this town. I'm going to leave my family, leave my brothers, whoever it was. I was going to leave them. And by the time I hit 18, I says, I'm going in the military. I've made up my mind. The military was going to be my career. That's going to be my job. I'm going to grow up and be a man. I really believe that in my head and soul. That's how I felt about it. And I did. Right as soon as I graduated from high school, I went down and enlisted, took all the tests, and took my physical, and lo and behold, them suckers failed me on my physical. Oh, I mean, people gave me a going-away party and all that good stuff. What the heck am I going to tell these people? I flunked my physical, you know, and I thought I was a happy, you know, 105 pounds, I guess. I just hit 6 foot, so I was skinny as a rail, and I thought I was healthy, and I flunked my physical. Man, I'll tell you, that was absolutely devastating. Well, my folks said, okay, we'll take you to the doctor, and we'll see what we can do, and they took me to the doctor, and they gave me a whole bunch of these tests, and they shot this dye into me, and said, oh, he's okay, he's just got a little protein in his kidneys, you know. They call it albumin, you know. He's okay, he can go in. So I went in the Air Force. I'm the only one from Youngstown, Ohio that enlisted on 1 October 1958. Mm-hmm. The only one. I mean, I don't know, maybe $1.50 will give me a cup of coffee over that one, I guess, you know. I did. I went in the Air Force, went into boot camp, and I realized I got down, I can't drink. They don't allow you to drink in boot camp. I mean, at least for the first 6 or 8 weeks. And I ended up 3 months in boot camp. And it was about the last 2 weeks of boot camp that gave us a 12-hour pass. Woo-wee. Man, I couldn't wait to get to the BX to drink that 3-2 beer. And because we couldn't get off post down at Lackland Air Force Base. That's where I went through basic training. And lo and behold, I drank as much as I could handle. And I couldn't find my way home. I absolutely couldn't. I mean, it was getting around 11 o'clock, 11-ish, somewhere around that area, and we had a 12 o'clock midnight curfew. And I'm running all over this base. I'm running in circles. You know why? all the buildings down there look alike. They do. They're all these World War II barracks. Okay? They're all painted yellow and white. And I couldn't remember the barracks building number. You know, I couldn't remember that. I was so damn drunk. I mean, I'm in my khakis and I'm sweating and I'm falling down. I fell in the sand, the dirt, you name it. And I don't know how the heck it ever happened, but I got in that door about 2 minutes before midnight. And I'm just pouring down with sweat. But that's what that 3-2 beer did to me then. But that I never stopped from there. And once I left there, I went to another duty station in South Carolina and almost got kicked out of the military my first year. I got involved with a lot of guys that did a lot of things. I was in supply, which was the lowest form of a job that one could have. At least that was my perception of it at that time. Security cops, cooks, and supply people were low on the totem pole. And to me, that was as low as I could ever feel. And I felt degraded because of that. I hated it. God, I hated it so much, you know. And so that first year was horrible. I drank nearly every night. If I had the money, I could drink. And if I didn't have the money, I tried to get money. And if I couldn't get the money, I was awfully upset with those people that wouldn't come out and take me out to get me a beer or get me drunk, you know. But I got through that. I don't know how I did. I should have been booted out. This young lieutenant stood me tall for an hour and had me in tears. And one thing I remembered him telling me, you go to jail, you can't drink. So I said, okay, I'll be good shoes or whatever you want to call it, you know. And I did. I out of sight, out of mind. I got transferred out of his organization, went to an aircraft maintenance organization, and I worked 24 on and 48 off now. You can't ask for a better time than that. Because 48 hours is nothing, but if I had the money, I drank. And I didn't have a car, so I had to walk off that base and walk to the nearest bars outside that base and get drunk. And then come home, we had curfews back then, too. We had certain times of curfew. And I couldn't walk through the gate because security cops would catch you. If they caught you drunk, you got big time. So I used to crawl over the fence. I a barbed wire fence, and I'd tear my uniform up, you know, my khakis or my fatigues. And that's how I got back to the barracks. And my barracks was just maybe 50 yards inside the main gate, but I had to go all the way around to get there, you know. That's tough when you're drunk, I'm telling you, you know. But that's the way it was. But I didn't know I was having a problem with alcohol. I loved drinking. That was all there was to it. I just loved it. And I drove a lot of the guys' cars without a license. I'm drunk, they're drunk, and I'm driving their car. And I blacked out in the middle of town in Greenville, South Carolina one day. One night. I couldn't believe, what am I doing here? I'm in the middle of an intersection. I don't even remember getting there. I mean, that's what alcohol was doing to me. And this is just beer, man, let me tell you. Because that was a dry county. You couldn't get liquor. If you went into a club, you had to bring your own bottle. And so, you know, that's what happened. That's what it took me. And then I got orders to go to Citadel of Suleiman, Turkey. Oh my God, that's a Muslim country and you can't drink. What am I going to do now? And they were very strict on alcohol in the Middle Eastern countries. So, you know, I didn't have a choice. I got orders. So I went home on vacation and drank as much as I could while I was on vacation on leave. And I got back to my base, reported into the first sergeant. He says, "Tramplers, come into my office." I said, "Oh, what'd I do now?" You know, kind of thing. And I always went in there with starch fatigue, spit shine shoes, a fresh haircut. Always, always, no matter what I could do. They'll always see how sharp I look. He's a sharp kid. Let's let him alone. Let's not bother him kind of attitude is what they had, you know. And he goes, "Your orders have been changed." I said, "Say what?" He says, "To where?" He says, "To Germany." I almost fell over. Oh my God. Going to Frankfurt, Germany. Not Rhein-Main, Germany, you know, outside of Frankfurt, but in Frankfurt. Whew. How close can you get to those opera houses and all that? How close can you get, you know? And I get off that plane, let me tell you, I'm prepared. I'm going to drink this German beer, man. I'm going to be king of the hill. Kind of. That was my attitude. I was a cocky little guy, you know? And I went into the Airman's Club at Rhine Mine there. I drank two beers, two big snap caps. Some guys had to carry me back to the barracks. I had passed out. And I woke up and I said this, I'm going to learn to drink like a man. That was my attitude, and that's the way I drank the whole time I was in Germany. You name it, I drank it, you know. And then I met Helga while we were there, and she was a telephone operator, interpreter for the German telephone company there, and her English was better than most Americans that I knew, and she didn't know all the slangs that the Americans were taught to talk to these women about, you know, and I did that, and it wasn't a happy experience either. You know, I seen this lady there. We met in a bar there. It was one of the social hangouts, and I looked at her, and she was with some other guy, and I looked at those blue eyes and said, I'm going to have her. And I worked on it, and I finally got a date with her, and we dated for about 14, 18 months. She knows the dates better than I do, and she always seems to know the dates better than me. But you know, in that courtship, we drank an awful lot. We really did. I don't know how we managed to do it. I don't know how we got through those that time. But then we married, and after we married, we went to her home for the wedding. And it was then I realized that this woman should not have ever married me. I knew that night. We stayed drunk for three solid days. I never drank so much in three solid days in all my drinking days. I mean, it was just horrible. And I was a horrible SOB. I wasn't a kind SOB. I was a horrible SOB. And how we got through that, I don't know. And our son was born there. Our oldest son was born in Frankfurt. And before he was born, I got to tell you this story, and there's a couple people here know that I've been into bowling for a number of years. And I bowled in the league in Frankfurt. And I told her she couldn't have her baby on my bowling night. And she didn't. But he was supposed to have been a Thanksgiving Day baby, but it was 10 days later when he finally decided it was time to meet the world, you know. But that was one of the things I thought, but that was more important to go bowling than to be with her and have a baby. It really was. And one thing I didn't realize at that time, I couldn't bowl and drink at the same time. But I did it over there. We always, we bowled for beer frames. And beer time, the game was over. I mean, I'm waltzing out that damn door, you know. But, you know, it went on like that for a long time in Germany. And we've been back many times over the last 25, 30 years. And we've gone to those places that we visited. Helga would say, do you remember that place? I said, what place? And every town that we ever drank in, she said, do you remember that place? I said, what place? I had no recollection. My mind was total blank. Even to this day, I can't remember those places that we drank at. But I can remember the problems I got into. That's one thing I always seem to remember. I was in Frankfurt, and we had this big alert during the Cuban crisis. And I was being in supply. We had to shot our weapons, and we had to take a trip. And we had to go, we didn't know where we were going, but we ended up in France. Because we were so close to, you know, we were like, from where we were stationed, was 10 minutes away from destruction by the Russians, okay? The guys up in Berlin, they had 5 minutes to live, so to speak. But, so we ended up in France. And that was quite a trip because we drank, I don't know how we ever got the booze there, but we did. But that's how it was for me, you know, in those days. I loved alcohol. I loved what it did for me. And I was getting in trouble while I was there. I remember going out getting drunk one night, I mean, plastered, and I was a standby driver. By the way, I didn't get a driver's license until I was 21 years old, and the military made me get one. You know, I was very resentful. I say resentful today, but I hated it back then, you know. How dare them? I can't afford a car or nothing. Why give me a license? But you're going to get one. And I did. And I had to pick up this command chaplain out of Kelly Air Force Base down in Texas. He's come up to visit our organization, and I had to go pick him up at Ryan Main. I got to Ryan Main okay. I just couldn't get back. I couldn't get back to Frankfurt. It's only like an hour and a half trip. Took me 5 hours. You know, I'm hungover. I'm trying to use humor as much as I could, but he wasn't smiling. You know, I don't know how the heck I ever got back. You know, because the last time I got to drive. I don't know how I got out of it, but I did. But I got other details, you know. But that's the way it was. And I got to get my thoughts together. I'm a scatterbrain at times. But once we came back to the States, I retrained in electronics, and down to Keesler Air Force Base. I don't know. I guess names don't mean too much to a lot of people. But I got down to the training center down in Mississippi, Gulfport, Mississippi. I stayed a whole year down there going to tech school. And I went through tech school totally drunk. The whole year I was drunk every day. I don't know how I ever passed my exams when they came up, and how I got out of tech school. I buddied around with three other guys that loved to drink alcohol. And we'd go out on the weekends. We'd carry our jugs with us, get in a car and go. And ride up and down the golf course there in Mississippi. And I don't know how I managed to do that. But I know one thing. I was so full of fear that alcohol couldn't even drown it out. I'd wake up with that fear again. That fear was an everlasting thing, and many times it is for me today. I couldn't drink enough to get rid of that fear. I'd wake up with it. I'd go out and get drunk with it. I'd wake up with it. It was a closed circle. And that's the way what alcohol did for me all these years. Fear drove me. And alcohol couldn't take it away. It just wouldn't turn off the head, you know. It wouldn't give me the... I thought I was full of confidence. I thought I was a smart kid, you know. I got through tech school in a year. How did I do it? Beat the hell out of me. But I never seen the school that I went to. I never worked on that equipment. They retrained me, what they call lateral train, into another radar field. And I got my orders just before Christmas of 64. Okay, going to Bismarck, North Dakota. Oh my God, I had to look on the map to find out where it was at. And I had to find out if they had natural gas up there. And someone told me they didn't. They had the biggest natural gas field in the whole country. And I ended up buying a trailer with oil burners and not natural gas. That's how ignorant I was. But we spent 10 years up there, and as Helga alluded to the fact that in those 10 years, I was scared to death. And I never got a chance to work in that radar field for a whole year when I got there. They said, Ray, you're going to work supply for a whole year, because they knew that was my prior training. And I was pretty upset about that, to say the least. I was angry. I was full of anger. And hell, I was always angry. You know, I don't think I had a peaceful moment in my life. But that took me places, because in 64 to 66, everything was, I finally got back into my career path, and I started studying, and I finally got a skill level where I could possibly get promoted. I actually got promoted while in my supply career path, okay, and not an electronic career path, which was fine with me, because that was money in my pocket. But, you know, In 66, Vietnam was, actually, way before 66, Vietnam had already started. Vietnam was getting full-blown already, okay? And we had a feeling that our organization was going to go, because we were a specialized organization. We were classified operations all across the country, and I knew that was going to happen. So when all these deployments came up, whether it's stateside or overseas, I volunteered for them. I got away from Bismarck because I could drink all I want when I was away. When I'm at home, I'm a closet drinker kind of thing. I'm a weekend binge drinker, okay? And that's the way it was for me. So I spent 10 and a half years on paper, but I only spent 3.5 years on post. And the rest of the time, I was deployed all across the country. You name in the state I probably was in, you know, and drank at all of them. And I couldn't tell you what the towns look like. I've been in Lubbock, Texas. I couldn't tell you what Lubbock looks like today. I've been in Longview, Texas. I couldn't tell you what Longview looks like. I've been down in Matagorda Island. I can't even tell you what that looks like. I've been in Colorado. I can't tell you what, because I was always drunk or on a blackout some way or another, you know. I just don't remember. That's what alcohol did for me. And after, you know, after the third deployment, then my fourth deployment, I went to the Philippines for 6 months. I had a $25 a day habit in the Philippines. And that's a lot of booze in the Philippines, if you know anything about the country. And I got hooked on San Miguel beer while I was there. San Miguel beer in country, they don't export it, has formaldehyde in it for preservatives. And I drank that. And you know, I never had a pain in my stomach the whole time I was there. I mean, my stomach never hurt the whole time. I could drink anything and as much as I want. I never had a stomach cramp at all. And I never threw up either. I passed out a lot, but I never got sick. I made a point. I'm not going to get sick. I don't know how. I don't know why, but I never got sick. You know, that's the kind of drunk I was. And so after I came back to the States, I jumped ahead just a skosh here. From 72 to 70, from 70 to 72, in between that, I had a very bad situation that happened. I physically hurt my wife, and I ended up in a psych ward for about 21 days at that time. And they classified it as a situation reaction. They didn't call it alcoholism. They didn't mention booze. No, nothing. And that's all they did. And I had to play the game to get out of there. I stayed there 21 days, and if I didn't play the game, they would have sent me to a military base, and that would have been the end of my career. I know at that time it would have been, because that's the way they were, okay? But I got out of there, went on controlled drinking. Oh my God, controlled drinking is horrible. If you know controlled drinking, you know what I'm talking about. It's horrible, because it's always on your mind. One of my sponsors always talks, well, you know, if you're not drinking, you're thinking about the drink all the time. And I didn't realize that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I realized the pattern that was set for me when I got here. And then we, you know, from 73 on, you know, we moved out here January 75, we came to California. And so I lasted a little longer than she did, okay, than Helga did. And I stayed drunk an awful lot over that NCO club, okay. And I came out here on a special assignment. All the things I ever dreamed about when I was a kid, I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to get up in front of the classroom and teach, okay. And I get this special assignment while I'm in Bismarck. You're going to Vandenberg Air Force Base. You're going to be assigned to Air Training Command. You're going to be an instructor. And I said, a what? Where? And what? You know, I had no idea what I was getting into. And I'm telling you, that fear set in like you wouldn't believe. I mean, I was petrified. I don't know how I even did it. I really don't. But I got here. I met my supervisor. And God, thank God for this guy. He was a top-notch supervisor. Top-notch. And I miss this man because I'll get into that in a minute. But he taught me how to teach. While I'm learning how to write lesson plans, learning how to teach equipment I never even seen, How am I, I didn't know if I had the capacity to do it. I really did. I'm full of fear. I'm drinking while I'm writing lesson plans. And once I got certified, I don't know how the hell he managed it. I guess I must have been sober enough that day, didn't notice it. Okay? And I got certified as an instructor. So I'm teaching at 6 o'clock in the morning to 12 at noontime. I couldn't wait. It's on my mind. 12 o'clock, club time, you know? And that's the way it was. And that was like that for over a year. And I don't know how I managed to do it. I really don't. But I can say this, and I don't know if it's good or bad. I never got a write-up from any of the students. No derogatory write-up from any of them. And I had to certify every one of them for their positions in that tracking station. And I don't know how I got away with it. To this day, I really don't. And there's only one guy up there that knows me, but he didn't know I was a drunk. And he's still there. He was a chief master. And we're friends today. He says, I know you. I work for you. So once I got out of that, I got to the tracking station. I retired out of the tracking station. And that was in 78. And in the meantime, in 76, after Helga got sober, she walked in the door. I've shared this before at other meetings. In 90 days, she walked in the door, and she was a different woman. I honestly, truly didn't recognize her when she walked through that door. She took her 90th day cupcake at the Lompoc Valley Group. And Freedom Group, I'm sorry. I always get corrected. That's where he was trying to hurry. Oh my goodness, I'm glad she's here tonight. I've got to tell a story because Eric asked me to pitch and find a 10-minute speaker. Well, I didn't hear the 10-minute speaker, so I never asked Helga. And then Helga asked me tonight, she says, you want me to come? I said, certainly, it's an AA meeting. You know? And I said, yeah, it's an AA meeting. Okay. And I'm pitching, and that's it. That was the end of it. It never even occurred to me there was going to be a 10-minute speaker. Okay? And I didn't ask her until we got here. You know? So life moves on at 52 years, you know? That's how it worked, you know, after that 90 days. And I went to my first meeting at the fairgrounds in August of 76, 5 August or 6 August, 5 August. I quit drinking on the 5th. I think the convention was on the 6th. I had my last two beers at work. And Bob Lemke, I'm allowed to use his name, he was at that meeting, and I don't remember what he says. I don't really want to listen to his tape anymore either. I don't want to listen to it because I want to remember that he planted HOPE. He put hope into my heart that night. And I sat with 1,200, I guess it was probably close to 1,200 people in that hall there that night. And I didn't know I could stop drinking. I really didn't. I had no desire, really. But I said, oh, okay, let's see if I can do it. I didn't know if I could go more than 1 or 2 days without a drink, you know. And I managed to do it for 30 days. I was thinking about a drink. Believe me, I really was. And in 30 days, I went to the meeting in Lompoc, and Norm Heath, who lives now in Ohio, he's got 42 years of continuous sobriety, personal friend of mine, he handed me how it works. And I always avoided that when I went to any meeting. I wouldn't read it because the first step said, you had to admit you're an alcoholic. Well, you know, you read that first step, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that at all. Well, that's what my perception was, so I avoided it until he gave me that thing that night, and that's when I admitted, intellectually speaking, that I was an alcoholic that night. But it was sometime after that, after I kept coming back, got into some local service work, if you will, found a sponsor, that it wasn't until I started working the steps of the program that I was able to finally admit that my life was unmanageable. You know, and now I understand what that unmanageability means to me today. And that's the most important step for me today, is I got to remember my life is always unmanageable. And I got to let whoever, you know, I call OG into my life all the time. And I do every day. And that's how it worked for me, you know. And once I admitted to my innermost self, at gut level, that I was able to cry for the first time, really cry. Gut level tears coming out, because I didn't know how, I wasn't going to cry for anybody, you know. I divorced my inner self with all those emotions that we carry. I will not cry for you or anybody else. I don't care who dies or who lives. I didn't give a damn. I didn't. I was divorcing those emotions. And now I got those emotions back today. I cry for people today. Okay? And working the steps of this program and getting into service work, and my sponsor, Dick Jones, who has since passed, took me got me involved in actual service work, okay, in H&I work. He says, you have 90 days, I'll take you into the federal prison over the camp meeting, okay, in Lompoc. You got to have 90 days first, but I don't know who got more impatient, him or me, but he took me in with less than 90 days. And he told me, don't tell them that you have less than 90 days or they'll kick us out. I was so damn excited when I got there. I'm telling you, when it was my turn to share, I said, I have less than 90 days. He about crawled under the table. He didn't know what was going to happen. But, you know, they allowed us to come back. And one thing I remembered about that is when I walked through the gates, okay, it clinged behind me before they opened the one in front of you. And I knew I was in a good lockup. I felt locked up right then and there. And then that second gate opened up and I went into that meeting and we shared. And I realized that I've been in the mental lockup all my life. And these guys were in a physical lockup. They just couldn't walk out and I could. So I had to do something with my life. I really did. And we got involved in service work for about the next 10 or 12 years after we left this area here and went down to Simi Valley and continued on for over 25 years of continuous sobriety down here. And that's how it's worked for me. And then Dick told me to find another sponsor, and I found another sponsor. His name was Joe Realm, and he was from Wisconsin, okay? And a great man, he had a brain that was unstoppable. He was so brilliant. He was so brilliant, they had to pick him out of the gutter to get him to an AA meeting. They literally had to. His sponsor had to pick him out of the gutter up on Interstate 5 up near Canyon Country. And he became my sponsor after I met him at our place of employment. And he became my sponsor for... I asked him to be my sponsor about a month or two after I met him. And Joe was my sponsor for 27 years. Great man. I'll tell you, he worked, helped me work through this program like you wouldn't believe. The last time I was with Joe, we were going up to Boise, Idaho. And he was going to go up and visit with his grandson and his daughter that lived up in Roslyn, or just outside of Boise. And he spent 3 days up there, and I bowled for 3 days. You know, I stayed out of his family way and all that, you know. And then he had a brand new Ford Escapader, whatever the hell it was, you know, SUV. And he's going up there to pick up a travel trailer. And we went, the day we left, we went and picked up this travel trailer, put a sway bar, that brand new sway bar on it. And we called Helga on the way home, and I said, well, I'm going to let Joe drive. He'll make all the mistakes. And we were just teasing, having fun with each other. 45 minutes later, we had a 360 rollover. I came out of it and Joe didn't. Joe died in that crash. I don't talk about that too much anymore because life moves on. You know, I've been given that opportunity to always remember him, to remember what he had done for me and what he has done for other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he kept an awful lot of, he used to have a lot of awful wet drinks come into his house and stay overnight, stay for weeks and months at a time. He was that kind of a man. He was a sharing man, caring man. But one of his fallacies was, and he always jokes about it, he was one of the sponsors. Up to then, Dick had two wives. Joe had four wives. And then I had to get a new sponsor, and I got a new sponsor. His name was Bob Baker. And we've known Bob for many years here in, when we got sober in Lompoc. He was here with us. It is 5 more years than us. And he had four wives. And these guys used to ask me about relationships. I said, what are you asking me for? He says, you've never been divorced. You know? So that was kind of a privilege to be able to sit there and share with them the problems that they were having. You know, it wasn't just sponsor, sponsee. It reversed itself. Friends and sponsor and sponsee. The same thing. That's what this program has given me, okay? And then after Bob passed, he says, Ray, you have to get a new sponsor, okay, if you're going to continue working this program. And these guys helped me work the steps. Joe and I used to sit down and read the big book. He'd come over to my house, and we'd go through the big book. We'd go through the steps, okay? That's how I was getting this program. When I got Bob, he told me when he moved back down to Florida, he says, Ray, you're going to have to go out and get another sponsor. You got to get one close to home. We can't do this long-distance sponsor. It don't work. You got to have one-on-one personal physical contact. And oh, man, I don't want to do this. You know, I really didn't. And so I went out to my mailbox one day, and I was getting my mail, and we get the grapevine. I opened up, oh, two grapevines. I said, why am I getting two grapevines? I look at mine. Oh, that's mine. I look at that. That's not my address. Oh, okay. Well, let me walk down to ring the doorbell, give it to whoever owns it. Well, the lady of the house opened the door, and I gave it to her. I said, this was in my box. Closed the door, didn't say another word. And I went home and told Helga, I think we got someone else on the program here. You know, I really think so. I think that's a good hint. And so what happens is a couple of days later, whatever, it doesn't matter. I went out to the mailbox, and he's out there. And I said, are you a friend of Bill Dudley? He said, yeah. And that's how Earl and I met. We met at the mailbox. Okay? And after we got acquainted, about another 30 days, says, will you be my sponsor? So Earl's been my sponsor, and Earl's got over 40 years of continuous sobriety. And that's how it's been working for me, you know? That's what God has put so many things in my life today. It's unbelievable. As you all know, sometimes we get up here and we share, you ought to have heard the pitch that I gave before a week or two. No, when was it? A month ago. Man, I'll tell you, it was a damn great pitch. And it's been like that every day. And finally today it says, oh, gee, you take over. Because I can't do it. I won't remember it, you know? And so I tried to be as quiet as I possibly can before I got here. And I'm grateful for that. And, you know, not only do we take care of ourselves, or I'm trying to take care of myself spiritually, morally, physically, you name it, on this program, I'm taking care of my body, you know, because it talks about it, and Bill and Dr. Bob talked about the physical body. You've got to get healed. You've got to get better. You've got to take care of your body. Well, I've been taking care of my body for many, many years now. And sometimes it went up, sometimes it went down, sometimes it went up, sometimes it goes in, you know? And now today it went in again, see? Because I'm making another commitment again to take care of my body, and my brain will follow, you know? Because I almost bit the bullet here 2 years ago, and I didn't know it. And I'm a runner. I run half marathons, okay? I've been running, and one day I'm not cutting the grass. And I feel this pain in my chest. And I was a little out of breath. I said, Ray, you got to get back to your running. Quit screwing around, you know. I give myself pep talks, guys. And so 6 weeks later, because Helga and Earl and my other sponsor, Ben, they're nurses. Those two are nurses. And I said, Ray, get your lower posterior to the hospital or to the doctors. I was going to use other words, but I'm learning to clean up my act over the years, you know. And so I did, and found out I had almost, it was so close to 100% blockage in one of my arteries. And I had no idea. I'm running, man. I'm feeling great. I'm doing 8 kilometers, 10 kilometers, 12 kilometers, you know, no problem. And now I'm back to running again. Doctor, go at it, kid. You know, I like it when it says kid, man. It makes me feel good, you know. I'm a mature individual. I'm not a senior citizen. You know? Look at Henry back there. He's older than I am. Look how healthy he is today. He's staying healthy, man. He's staying sober. And guys like him, they help me stay sober another day. They're an inspiration. They truly are. And there's a lot of people in this room that, there's two of them here. I've been given the privilege of sponsoring them, and they're here today. And I'm so grateful for that, because they carry the message for me. You know, they help me stay sober the day to time. I was going to get into a lot of the steps, Ned, but I think I've talked about the steps and what the steps have been doing to me in my life. And so I'm truly grateful to be allowed to be up here. And in all honesty, and as some of you all know, and I owe Eric an apology and a couple other people, because I said, I don't want to pitch. I don't want to do this. I can't do this. I'm afraid to do this. I don't do it well. I go home and I chastise myself for pitching, you know. And that's how I honestly felt. And it wasn't until a sharing of the Tuesday night meeting convinced me unequivocally, Ray, you will stand up in front of this podium and share your experience, strength, and hope. Because if I don't, I know I'm going to go home and I'm going to chastise myself, or stay home and chastise myself. Who knows? Who knows what it could lead to? Because I couldn't get the courage or ask God to come in my life, to give me the faith and the courage to come up here and do this. And I'm so grateful that I'm able to do it. And I'm grateful for my wife for showing up. but, you know, that's the way it is for us. You know, after 52 years, everything is not perfect. Not near perfect. But one thing we have, and we've talked about it in the past, we just didn't run from our problems. We hung in there, no matter what. It's like I heard someone say, I don't belong to the no matter what club. Well, I belong to that club. I no matter what, I'm not going to take a drink. Okay, no matter what. When my sister committed suicide, I didn't take a drink. Okay, why? I called everybody across the damn country to help me stay sober that day, to get me through that crisis in my life that day. She committed suicide at 66 years old. Okay, 3 days before that, my brother almost died in an auto accident. Okay, I just asked God for help and to give her blessings. You know, she may have taken her life, but she's still with me. You know, and I'm so sorry. I miss my sister dearly, but I didn't have to drink over that, because you taught me what to do, when to do it, and why I must do it. And that's what I did. I called people in Minnesota, in Ohio, in Arkansas, in Florida, in California, okay? All those places, they were there for me. And I hope you guys get those telephone numbers and carry them with you. That's my suggestion, because you don't know when it's going to happen. You just don't know. And for me, I wanted to... make sure that what I'm doing on this program is going to keep me sober one more day, you know. And all of that is contingent on my spiritual being with the power of my understanding today. And that's what it takes for me. And I choose to call him OG. After me, you can ask me who OG is, and I'll tell you. And I want to thank you for allowing me the privilege of being here and sharing with you guys. And I hope you all stay, those that are new and those that are struggling with this program. Believe me, there is hope no matter what. No matter what. Thank you.
All
let's give him one more round of applause, please.
Okay, with